the public peace. Henry responded by promulgating the first public peace, Landfrieden, at Mainz in 1103, with the backing of the Dukes of Bavaria, Zeringen, and Swabia. Intended to last 4 years, this was already broken by renewed rebellion early in 1105. However, it would be wrong to dismiss it as a failure. Henry had resumed his father's peace policy, but adapted it to the empire's new political balance, initiating a form of peacekeeping that would shape imperial political and judicial practice until 1806. His successors promulgated similar measures, though no copies survive before Barbarossa's public peace of 1152. The preservation of this text was due to a major effort to disseminate its terms in writing to all bishops, counts, and margraves. It was renewed in 1179, and followed by further more restricted versions in 1186 and 1223, before Frederick II issued another general peace in 1235. All these measures intended a general pacification of the empire, rather than the local truces attempted in France. Each measure was agreed by the king at a general assembly of major lords who swore to uphold it. The impulse was the widespread desire to surmount the cycle of civil wars between 1073 and 1106 by replacing violence with more peaceful arbitration. Crucially, the king now submitted to the peace himself, rather than trying to stand above it like Henry III. Henry IV's experience demonstrated that reliance on force merely lent credence to his opponent's charges of royal tyranny. The last two Salians and their Stauffer successors wanted to place opponents in the wrong as potential peacebreakers. Meanwhile, promulgation through an assembly obliged those present to assist in upholding it. Crusading ideology, preached since 1095, also played a part for both Conrad III and Barbarossa, who embraced the Pope's call for peace amongst Christians to enable warriors to go to the Holy Land. Finally, the measures reflected new concepts of peace itself. In the early Middle Ages, it was believed that peace was best established by allowing each social group and community to be left undisturbed in possession of its rights. This legitimated the feud that was intended to assert rights against those who ignored or usurped such rights. By the 12th century, peace was understood more in terms of right and wrong, with all violence perceived as a direct threat to tranquility. However, this development did not mitigate the trend towards harsher justice. The 1103 public peace incorporated bloody punishments, including blinding or amputation of a hand for theft, robbery, and extortion, while those directly breaching the peace were to be maimed and deprived of their property and fief. These penalties were not simply for deterrent effect. They were considered fairer than the earlier system of fines, which the poor found harder to pay. While the public peace legislation reinforced the emperor as supreme judge, this was not a role he was either willing or able to perform often. The emperor was involved in settling at least 150 cases in royal towns across 1101 to 1254, including 80 in the last 30 years of that period. This gives a small indication of the potential total volume of business across the empire, which was clearly beyond the capacity of any medieval king to handle. The public peace was intended to free the king from the burden of lesser cases, whilst reserving to him those involving princes and other immediate lords. Worldly imperfections were fully recognized in the temporary nature of each public peace. A king was not expected to enforce verdicts, leaving those involved free to accept his judgment or find their own settlement. For this reason, the public peace retained the option to feud. This approach was pragmatic, encouraging peaceful resolution, whilst recognizing this was not always possible, given that disputes involved not just the pride and face of those immediately concerned, but that of their clients and supporters. Violence was permitted, but contained and channeled through measures intended to ensure that those using excessive force forfeited the legitimacy of their case. For example, the 1235 peace contained clauses to protect economic activity by guaranteeing the safety of royal highways even during a feud. The idea of the public peace survived the Staufer's demise because it represented a practical way to confront violence whilst protecting the interests of those charged with enforcing it. King William issued one in 1255 as part of his alliance with the Rhenish Civic League, while Richard of Cornwall promulgated another in 1268. Rudolf I and his successors renewed these measures, either for the entire empire, 1287, 1290, 1298, or for specific regions, 1276, 1281, 1289. Renewed conflict after 1298 interrupted these developments, which resumed under Charles IV, who renewed the general peace in 1354 prior to his Roman coronation journey. The Golden Bull consolidated existing practice by charging the electors with upholding the peace and making peace maintenance the primary task of future leagues and unions in the empire. The emergence of a judicial hierarchy. Royal peace initiatives helped realign judicial practices with the emerging status hierarchy and the needs of a society structured more obviously into corporate estates. The 1231 Charter to Princes gave dukes, bishops, counts, and margraves expanded magisterial powers, not only over their own vassals and servants, but over virtually all the inhabitants in their jurisdiction. In the longer term, this represented an important step in territorializing princely power. More immediately, it adjusted conflict management and resolution to the new division of labor, since the princes were now charged with judging infractions according to the definition of crimes and scale of punishments agreed in the public peace. This change clearly identified princes as exercising powers of corporal punishment, Blutsgerichtsbarkeit, and helped identify their courts as superior, since such cases had to be referred to them from the localities. Combined with mint, toll, tax, and other rights, these new powers were important elements in marking the princes as a distinct status group. Concern for status helped make the system work, because the desire to deny outsiders excuses to intervene was a powerful incentive for princes to keep their own jurisdictions in order. Generally, a two-tier judicial hierarchy developed within these princely jurisdictions by 1300. The lowest tier emerged as lords retreated from direct management of towns and villages, which established local courts chaired by mayors. These usually met four times a year to judge a broad range of disputes and crimes, punishable mainly by fines. A second, higher tier emerged with the development of districts as administrative subdivisions within princely fiefs. District courts were chaired by officials representing the prince and usually had a circuit, Gerichtssprengel, of up to 10 villages that they toured to hear more serious cases. A third tier appeared around 1500 as superior territorial courts were established, either as a Hofgericht, chaired by the prince, or as a territorial court, Landgericht, under an appointed judge. These central courts institutionalized the central exercise of bloody jurisdiction across an entire territory, regardless of its formal division into different fiefs. The establishment of these superior courts was usually underpinned by additional imperial privileges, such as those granted to Trier in 1458. The hierarchical structure was mirrored in the imperial and free cities, where a lesser magistrate's court, Ratsgericht, handled minor transgressions, like breaches of civic ordinances or building regulations, while a superior city court, Stadtgericht, judged serious crimes like murder, arson, theft, or rape, and could impose corporal punishment. While varying considerably in detail, all courts adhered to broadly similar norms and procedures. Judgment by peers had already been part of Ottonian practice and continued as trial by 7 to 12 jurors selected from upstanding members of the community. The judge was assisted by a clerk, while by the 15th century, cases could be brought by an official prosecutor as well as by a plaintiff. Despite the trend to more formalized written procedures, the emphasis remained more on mediation than determining guilt and punishment. In some regions, jurors were required to seek an amicable settlement prior to a case coming to court. Cases involving insult or slander used a process called sending, Beschickung, in which a third party was delegated to ask what the offender had really intended. Neighbors were expected to engage in saving, retten, intervening to break up fights and prevent serious harm. Appellate justice. The development of a longer judicial hierarchy extended the open-ended character of justice by enabling cases to be appealed against or referred to superior courts for additional adjudication. Already from the 12th century, the new towns founded east of the Elbe would call on their mother cities for legal advice, while the spread of universities after 1348 led to difficult cases being referred to law faculties, which functioned by 1530 as a kind of appeals court. These practices evolved in consequence of the division of judicial labor intended to free the emperor to concentrate on disputes among the princely elite. Appeals to the emperor became a special, restricted privilege already in the Staufer era. Frederick II appointed a royal justiciar in 1235 to relieve him of the burden of judging cases himself. Although this post lapsed during the 1250s, it was revived in February 1274 as permanent, yet with a more restricted remit for cities and counts, but no longer princes, whose disputes were still judged by the monarch. The advisory council developed into the Kammergericht, Cameral Court, which accompanied the king on his royal progress and had its own chancellery, Kanzlei, to record proceedings. The limited remit of royal justice encouraged additional local initiatives, particularly in response to the greater social unrest and political disorder of the 14th and 15th centuries. The most notorious were the freelance courts called Veme, operating between 1300 and 1450 in Westphalia, and sometimes beyond in areas rarely visited by the king. These were largely self-appointed courts, but were protected by the Archbishop of Cologne, and sometimes enjoyed royal sanction to uphold the public peace. They met openly if the accused appeared voluntarily, but otherwise convened in secret, and in practice served as vehicles for Westphalia's nobles to consolidate their local and regional power. Their potential was limited, and they disappeared once open opposition from Frederick III dissuaded local princes from allowing them to hear further cases. The public peace measures of 1383 and 1389 adjusted to the development of more clearly delineated territorial judicial systems by grouping these on a regional basis, prefiguring the Kreis structure adopted after 1500. In contrast to 13th century practice, binding princes to uphold the peace through their feudal obligations, the 1383 measures envisaged associations of all immediate lords acting more autonomously to maintain order in their own region. This development was backed by the princes, because they, rather than the knights and towns, were primarily responsible for judging serious cases in their region. These measures could be effective. Count Dietrich von Wernigerode was executed by his peers in 1386 for breaking the peace. After the efforts at a general peace in the 1380s, similar measures continued to be made on a regional basis after 1400, but were hindered by princes' growing reluctance to submit their disputes to arbitration. As we have heard, The result was an escalation in violent feuding that spread from the elite to other sections of society. However, all late medieval associations continued the culture of collective conflict resolution and peace enforcement. The Swabian Leagues Court handled 250 cases across 1488 to 1534, three quarters of which involved disputes between different status groups, like towns and princes. Cases involving disputes with non-members often proved difficult if these refused to acknowledge the court's jurisdiction. Consequently, demands for more effective royal justice became a central element in imperial reform. Initial efforts in 1442 faltered, but Frederick III secured successive extensions of a new general public peace after 1465. Following 1467, breaches of the peace were treated as crimen lysae maiestatis, effectively stigmatizing them as rebellion and allowing those responsible to be placed under the imperial ban. The Turkish menace was invoked to enjoin Christians to stop fighting each other and combine against the infidel. The prospect of a more severe punishment added pressure to establish a more effective appellate court as a final tribunal, ensuring that public peace cases were handled fairly. The Kammergericht had suffered from the general dissipation of regalia rights since the 1370s, when the post of judge was often pawned to princes allied to individual emperors. For example, Frederick III transferred it to successive bishops of Passau between 1461 and 1470, and then to Archbishop Adolf II of Mainz. Like the modern practice of entrusting public functions to semi-private agencies, operators had an incentive to improve efficiency by reducing costs and boosting receipts through fees and fines. Calls for a permanent, independent court grew louder from 1471. But serious problems only emerged when no one was willing to assume the franchise after Adolf's death in 1475. The reform of imperial justice. Negotiations at royal assemblies after 1486 led to the promulgation of the Eternal Public Peace in 1495. Like the rest of imperial reform, this was a compromise combining past practice with genuine innovation. The peace's eternal character was less significant than the ban on feuds and all forms of violent self-help as a legal means of redress, shifting debate away from the legitimacy of individual feuds to condemning the entire practice. A second innovation was the creation of a new permanent supreme tribunal, officially called the Emperor's and Empire's Cameral Court, but generally shortened to Reichskammergericht. The court was given a printed procedural ordinance, completed on the 7th of August 1495. Personnel were sworn in on the 31st of October, and they heard the first case 3 days later, indicating that the Empire could act swiftly when the necessary consensus was there. Several additional features make the Reichskammergericht appear more modern than its equivalents in other European countries. It was independent from the royal household, moving instead between various imperial cities before settling in Speyer after 1527, until that city was sacked by French troops in 1689. The court reopened 4 years later in Wetzlar, where it stayed until the Empire's demise. The court's independence was enhanced by how its judges were selected. The emperor named the presiding Kammerrichter, but the other Assessoren were nominated by the imperial estates, who were obliged to cooperate through the new Kreis structure to present candidates to the court, which, after the very first appointments, made the final choice itself. Personnel swore loyalty to the court, not to the lords or cities that had nominated them, and there is considerable evidence that they acted genuinely independently and collectively. The Reichskammergericht's jurisdiction covered Germany, and initially also Burgundy, but but not Switzerland or Italy. One task was to uphold the eternal peace by adjudicating disputes amongst all individuals and communities enjoying the status of imperial immediacy, thereby largely rendering regional peace leagues redundant. As previously, each immediate authority was charged with keeping order within its own jurisdiction through the hierarchy of local, district, and territorial courts. The Reichskammergericht's second task was as a final court of appeal for cases from these territorial judiciaries. This aspect operated unevenly across the empire, according to the varying degrees with which each territory had secured the privilege of not appealing, Privilegium de non appellando, since 1356, when the Golden Bull exempted the elector's subjects from the jurisdiction of the Royal Kammergericht in return for their establishment of territorial courts of appeal. Other princes' claims for exemption on customary grounds were rejected, and they had to negotiate their own separate privileges with the emperor, creating a new concession that could be traded for political support. Usually, only limited privileges were granted, still reserving important cases for the Reichskammergericht. Privileges were important mainly for prestige reasons and required princes to establish their own appeals structures. Some princes acquired so-called unlimited privileges in the 18th century, but prior to 1803, even these did not exclude all appeals, while the Reichskammergericht could intervene regardless if territorial courts broke their own procedures or denied subjects justice. The most extensive immunity was the exemption of the entire Burgundian lands as part of the wider demarcation of Habsburg possessions in 1548, and based on the existence of a permanent Burgundian appellate court in Mechelen after 1504. Immunities could be revoked, most notably those of Mecklenburg, following an appeal by the Duchy's estates against the Duke in 1785. This case is particularly significant because the ruling denied the Duke's claims that his privileges rested on the Peace of Teschen, 1779, which had been guaranteed by France and Russia. The Reichskammergericht was joined by the Reichshofrat as a second supreme court established in Vienna by Maximilian I in December 1497, to safeguard the judicial aspects of his imperial prerogatives. The new court was not universally welcomed, and effectively disappeared with Maximilian's death in 1519. Ferdinand I reconstituted it by detaching responsibility for imperial prerogatives from the Habsburgs' own territorial superior court in 1559. Unlike the Reichskammergericht, the Reichshofrat was entirely staffed by Habsburg appointees and had jurisdiction across the empire, including Italy, on the basis that the emperor was feudal lord of all those with imperial immediacy. It was not intended to compete with the Reichskammergericht, but soon strayed into its business because issues arising from fiefholding, like inheritance disputes, could become breaches of the peace. Additionally, the court exercised the emperor's prerogatives of grace and pardon, allowing it to expand its remit to include appeals from territorial subjects by the later 16th century. Its closer relationship to the emperor encouraged plaintiffs, who hoped verdicts in their favor would be backed by the full weight of Habsburg power. To reduce friction, cases could not be transferred between the two courts by litigants seeking more favorable verdicts. In practice, disputes were often so complex that several parallel proceedings ran simultaneously. The impact on judicial practice. The Reichskammergericht profoundly influenced judicial practice throughout the empire, as did the Reichshofrat once it caught up by adopting written procedures in 1559. At both courts, the presiding judge assigned cases to senates, panels of legally trained assessors who received written memoranda and arguments submitted by lawyers representing the contending parties, in a complete contrast to the oral, face-to-face confrontational process prior to 1495. Both courts could empower commissioners to gather additional evidence, including taking witness statements. These methods were copied by territorial courts, which also changed their procedures in criminal cases to follow the 1532 Carolina Code in standardizing inquisitorial methods and shifting the obligation to prove guilt from the accuser to a prosecutor. The changes were not universally beneficial. For example, making it far easier to level accusations of witchcraft without fear of punishment if they could not be proved. The greater emphasis on establishing guilt encouraged the widespread use of torture to extract confessions, directly contributing to the witch craze as prosecutors sought to identify others involved in what were believed to be communal deviant practices. Neither the Carolina Code nor the territorial codes derived from it offered much protection against arbitrary arrest, and often a denunciation was sufficient, especially if the accused belonged to rootless or marginal social groups. German territorial courts executed 22,500 alleged witches during the 16th and early 17th centuries, mostly through the failure of local authorities to follow official inquisitorial procedures or to restrain overzealous prosecutors. Since witchcraft was defined as a crime, and so was reserved to territorial, bloody jurisdiction, the imperial courts could only intervene on grounds of procedural irregularities, but they managed to curb prosecutions in some areas. As inquisitorial practice became more sophisticated, the need for torture decreased well ahead of its official abolition in most territories during the 18th century. The authorities still used harsh measures, such as locking up suspects until they confessed, but also undertook detailed investigations, especially in complex cases. The Sachsen-Hildburghausen contractor, Moses Schimmel, was asked 1,500 questions during his interrogation on corruption charges between 1771 and 1775, with his answers carefully recorded in 6 volumes of court documents. The 1495 Reichskammergericht Ordinance was revised in 1521 and 1555, but subsequent changes remained administrative and financial, not legal, because confessional controversy made it politically difficult to alter judicial procedures. New procedural rules were ready by 1613, only to founder on lack of agreement in the Reichstag, though they were unofficially adopted in 1654, when the Reichshofrat also received a revised ordinance. Consequently, the imperial courts remained guided by the 16th century understanding of Roman law and failed to match new legal thinking that increasingly shaped how territorial courts operated. This was not as serious as it might first appear, because both imperial courts remained primarily tasked with brokering viable compromises rather than reaching definitive verdicts. More problematic was their adherence to secret hearings and decisions published without explanations, because it was feared transparency might undermine their authority. This helps explain why Reichskammergericht verdicts in the 16th century religious cases encountered so much opposition, fueling the controversy that hamstrung the visitation or monitoring process through the Reichstag after 1588. The next visitations were not conducted until 1707 to 1714 and 1767 to 1776, and were primarily concerned with the court's internal administration and finance. The Prussian judiciary began explaining its verdicts after 1793, and some imperial judges soon copied this unofficially. Neither court was well staffed, considering they served over 20 million people by the 18th century. The Reichshofrat had 14 to 20 judges at any one time in the 16th century, rising to 25, backed by 34 chancery staff, after 1600. These met 3 to 4 times a week, considering up to 20 cases each session. The Reichskammergericht was likewise overburdened, and its staffing levels were a constant issue at the Reichstag. It was at, or close to, full complement between 1566 and 1610, falling to a low point between 1648 and 1713, when there were never more than 13 judges in post, forcing its temporary closure from 1704 to 1709. Official staff levels were halved in 1720, but individual pay was doubled, and a real effort was made to avoid future vacancies, something that was achieved consistently after 1782. Total staff numbers were larger at around 150, with an additional 50 legal trainees and solicitors helping with the paperwork. Caseload. Given the staffing problems, the caseload is astonishing. Details survive for about 80,000 Reichskammergericht cases, but the total was probably higher, while the Reichshofrat handled around 140,000 cases, of which files still exist for about half. The overall volume of cases was greater still, because each court also dealt with revisions and renewals of existing cases, for instance, tripling the Reichshofrat's total business. The relative balance fluctuated, with the Reichshofrat generally receiving more cases each time the Reichskammergericht was in difficulties. The extension of immunities reduced the proportion of new cases reaching the Reichskammergericht from 4/5 to half or less of its business, but it was still handling more cases annually in the early 1800s than it had around 1500, while the Reichshofrat managed a threefold increase across the same period. Inevitably, a considerable backlog developed, drawing hostile comment, especially after 1806. According to Goethe, there were 50,000 unresolved cases and a further 20,000 pending before the Reichskammergericht in 1771. But these figures are wildly inflated. Although the actual total cannot be reconstructed, the court had cleared the entire backlog by 1780. Around 4,000 Reichshofrat cases built up by the mid-1760s, mainly due to the Seven Years' War. But these had been resolved by the end of the decade, during which time it handled 10,000 new ones. By contrast, the backlog before the European Court of Human Rights reached 150,000 in 2012. Some cases took years to resolve. 4% of those introduced at the Reichskammergericht in the late 16th century were still ongoing a century later. Again, this requires interpretation, because the task was not to solve them, but to encourage peaceful settlement, with prolonged engagement in practice being successive adjustments according to changed circumstances. Both courts could appoint commissioners who could act quickly and forcefully if life was endangered. Court mandates could be backed by troops mobilized through the Kreiser. Brokerage was more common, with mediation accounting for 42% of all Reichshofrat commissions under Ferdinand III, while 54% of those handled by Württemberg across 1648 to 1806 were for the same purpose, compared to just 15% to enforce verdicts. Enforcement relied on the cooperation and compliance of the imperial estates, both those entrusted with this task and those affected by the case. The difficulties this entailed increased the desire for workable solutions, which were generally achieved, and probably no more than 100 decisions of both courts combined remained unenforced across the empire's last 150 years. Preserving the peace. Most of the cases involving those with immediacy stemmed from dynasticism, which changed princely inheritance practices. For example, attempts to divide the possessions of the Ernestine Saxons in 1680 produced 61 Reichshofrat cases across 1699 to 1730, just involving the Saxon-Coburg branch, while disputes amongst Lippe-Detmold's ruling family contributed 65 Reichskammergericht cases between 1613 and 1783. Questions of inheritance, marriage, guardianship, and maintaining relatives accounted for 30% of all Reichshofrat commissions from 1637 to 1657, or twice the number of cases over territorial rights, and six times more than those about feudal rights. Again, imperial judicial practice reflected wider social characteristics. Ordinary inhabitants made increasing use of the lesser courts to resolve similar status and inheritance disputes. Only a tiny minority of cases resulted in the imposition of the imperial ban. The 1495 Reichstag authorized the Reichskammergericht to ban those breaking the peace, but in practice, the emperor always insisted on doing this through the Reichshofrat. The 1559 Reichstag abandoned earlier efforts to assert the imperial estate's involvement and allowed the emperor to issue a ban without a prior hearing on the basis of notoriety. This proved unproblematic when employed against individuals like the knight Wilhelm von Grumbach, who appeared a public menace. But Ferdinand II's use of these powers as a political weapon during the Thirty Years' War caused considerable disquiet. Nonetheless, later emperors continued to ban opponents, notably during the War of the Spanish Succession, until Charles VI agreed at his accession in 1711 that he would consult the Reichstag in future. Prussia's invasion of Saxony in August 1756 put this to the test, because Austria hoped to use this clear breach of the peace to ban Frederick II, thereby providing grounds to deprive him of his possessions in the event of victory. Prussian sympathizers blocked the motion in the Reichstag, which simply sanctioned peacekeeping mobilization. This was an exceptional case. The Reichshofrat threatened the ban on 160 occasions after 1559, but only imposed it 9 times, 5 of which were at the start of the Thirty Years' War. The ban was rarely necessary, because open rebellion was extremely unusual in the early modern empire, while the Reichshofrat was able to impose meaningful sanctions through its normal judicial process, for example, deposing at least 6 princes between 1684 and 1727. Charles VII agreed at his accession in 1742 to consult the Reichstag before deposing further princes. But both imperial courts continued to remove princes on criminal charges on the basis of their bloody jurisdiction over immediate vassals, deposing 4 princes this way between 1770 and 1793. Diffusing social tension. The court's remit was expanded considerably by the 1526 Reichstag's ruling that complaints from ordinary subjects could be appealed, provided certain procedures were observed. Passed in response to the Peasants' War, this measure achieved its goal of channeling protest away from open violence and towards resolution through judicial and administrative review. This process has been labeled juridification and involved a fundamental change in behavior at all social levels. Lords had previously used violence to assert authority and status. Feuding had been criminalized in 1495, and now repression was likely to be condemned in the courts. For example, the Duke of Württemberg was obliged to return his troops to barracks after his subjects protested in 1701 and 1765, while the Prince of Nassau-Siegen, 1707, and the Duke of Mecklenburg, 1728, were both deposed after they used their soldiers to seize their subjects' property in disputes over taxation and religious freedom. The authorities generally perceived that the new practices were in their own interests, since the wider imperial framework allowed them to call on their neighbors' military assistance should their own subjects fail to restrict their protests to judicial channels. These principles were incorporated into territorial judicial procedures. For example, despite Austria's effective exemption from Reichskammergericht jurisdiction, Its legislation extended rights of appeal, through its own courts, to common inhabitants in 1579. Thus, both the empire and its constituent territories practiced a form of peasant protection, Bauernschutz, by inserting the courts between ordinary folk and lordly exploitation. These changes were not universally welcome. Recourse to the courts often appeared part of the problem, not the solution, thanks to the costs, time, and uncertainty involved. It also contradicted the faith that a benevolent ruler should respond promptly and positively once informed of his subjects' distress. Access to appellate justice was accompanied by curbs on direct petitioning, making the courts appear to be new barriers between inhabitants and princes. Courts were also staffed by nobles and educated commoners, both same groups wielding socio-economic power. Although the imperial courts operated on the principle of presumed liberty, considering people to be free unless proven otherwise, it was often difficult for ordinary folk to provide written evidence to refute lordly claims on their labor and produce. The appeals system did not eliminate violence, particularly as frustration could build through delay and explode if the courts did not produce the expected justice, as we have observed in Saxony in 1790. While nothing matched the Peasants' War, there were major revolts in Upper Austria in 1594 to 1597, 1626, and 1632 to 1636, as well as in Bavaria in 1633 to 1634, and 1705 to 1706. All but the first of these events were exacerbated by war. Otherwise, protest was largely confined to five waves of unrest in smaller territories, broadly correlating with hunger crises and wartime taxation. 1650 to 1660, 1700 to 1716, 1725 to 1733, 1752 to 1766, and 1767 to 1777. Beyond these, there were at least 30 major disturbances in imperial cities after the 16th century, as well as numerous smaller incidents, including 55 in Hessen and 380 in Ansbach bei Reuth, from the mid-17th to the late 18th century. These all paled in comparison to the general revolts in Bohemia, 1679, 1775, Hungary, 1660s, 1671 to 1681, 1703 to 1711, and Transylvania, 1784, under Habsburg rule. Outside the Habsburg lands, violence was generally contained. Peasants and burghers used strikes, petitions, and bluster, often alongside court cases, in carefully coordinated strategies to pressure the authorities into conceding demands. The significance of juridification lay in opening formal channels of communication and encouraging acceptance that clear, simple answers were unlikely to resolve complex problems. The courts recognized that absolute verdicts could escalate violence. For example, the Reichshofrat rejected the Bishop of Basel's appeals for a final verdict in his favor against his estates in 1730 to 1733, because this would have made his subjects desperate. This helps explain the length of many cases, in which the imperial and territorial superior courts acted more as mediators than as institutions seeking to determine guilt or innocence. Neither this nor the enlightened reforms of the later 18th century were a conscious strategy of defensive modernization, intended to reform from above to avert revolution from below. None of the empire's numerous authorities predicted what was coming after 1789, but many were certainly anxious. The Prince of Hohenzollern-Hechingen was at loggerheads with his subjects over feudal demands after 1584. In what became one of the empire's longest-running disputes. Disagreement increasingly focused on his attempts to use forced labor to extend and maintain his hunting grounds, a move that simultaneously curtailed peasants' access to the territory's forest. Efforts to confiscate the peasants' hunting guns stirred such opposition that the prince feared revolt and called in Württemberg troops during the 1730s. However, repeated recourse to the Reichskammergericht managed the situation, upholding the prince's feudal jurisdiction but halting his repressive measures. Württemberg was obliged to recall its troops, and future intervention only proceeded with official sanction as peacekeepers organized through the Swabian Kreis. Violence was largely avoided, and a new prince ended the dispute in 1798 by renouncing feudal jurisdiction over all but one particularly recalcitrant village. The emphasis on the local and particular was thus double-edged. It provided all the empire's social groups and communities with opportunities to achieve real gains by basing their demands on specific, identifiable rights. For example, the Reichshofrat imprisoned Count Karl Magnus of Greyweiler for 10 years after he had forged his subjects' consent to huge loans for his building projects. More powerful rulers, including those in Mecklenburg, Württemberg, Bavaria, Saxon-Weimar, and Reuss, also lost cases in the second half of the 18th century. However, the aversion to abstract, absolute ideals fragmented protest, preventing both politicization and thus the likelihood of violence, but also isolating those involved from potential allies. The Hechingen peasants failed to obtain support from inhabitants in neighboring territories, despite often similar problems there. Differences over strategy also weakened popular movements, contributing to factionalism within communities. The Hechingen case illustrates a second general point. Popular unrest and court intervention were both most frequent in the empire's smaller territories. Kornelimünster Abbey, with just 5,000 subjects, produced 200 Reichskammergericht cases, while nearly a fifth of the 1,100 cases from Lippe-Detmold to the same court across 1522 to 1806 were brought by subjects against the prince or his officials. Like the intervention of imperial debt commissions, court involvement was a consequence of these territories under development. The small scale of such territories placed ruler and ruled in close proximity, leaving few intervening administrative layers to defuse tension. Above all, the absence of appellate courts necessitated direct recourse to imperial justice. 833 of Lippe's cases were appeals. Peasants generally developed a favorable view of the empire's supreme courts, whose adherence to standardized procedures often contrasted with seemingly capricious seigneurial justice. Lords, especially in smaller territories, had tried to assert social distance by manipulating their judicial powers, placing themselves above the law, whilst dispensing clemency periodically to win acceptance of their elevated position. Juridification, after 1526, bound them within a system beyond their personal control. It objectified justice, removing, or at least lessening the impact of individual circumstances, especially as imperial law applied to all and was widely disseminated through print. Although governance still involved brokerage, this was now less personalized and blatant, since it ran through institutionalized channels rather than through vassalage and patrimonialism. Territorial authorities were represented more by public officials than the prince. Official claims to impartiality gained some credence when real results were obtained, and individual officials rejected prevailing prejudices about peasants as naturally unruly. Adherence to common core values enabled even elementary differences to be fought out without straining the existing order, which all parties recognized as legitimate. The rule of law. The famous German state under the rule of law, Rechtsstaat, was thus a product of the empire's long evolution and not a reaction to the French Revolution. The existence of the Rechtsstaat explains why most inhabitants felt French-style revolution was unnecessary or even harmful. The imperial court safeguarded access to law and equal treatment in the judicial process, but not full legal equality. Most people continue to regard injustice as an unwarranted disruption of a harmonious order, refusing to accept that conflict was inherent in all unequal socio-economic power relations. Judicial intervention stabilized the empire, both curbing violence and perpetuating gross inequality. Society remained local, corporate, and hierarchical. In fact, the courts were increasingly called upon by ordinary people in the later 18th century to defend local privileges against the rationalizing, leveling ambitions of territorial governments seeking more equal, but also more intrusive relationships with their inhabitants. Late 18th century critics condemned the empire's judicial framework as confusing and incapable of effective protection through its lack of a single, uniformly applicable legal code. However, as we have heard, territorial codification was slow and failed to improve individual security. On the contrary, the wider protection of imperial appellate justice was removed in 1806 without any alternative safeguards being installed. Writing in May 1806, on the eve of the empire's dissolution, the Habsburg official Josef Haas praised the judicial power, which was until now the shining jewel of our constitution. Two imperial courts, whose counselors were appointed with great care and were free of external influence, competed with each other in the impartial administration of justice and gave even the lowest subject right against the most powerful prince. Haas predicted that once this system was removed, there would be nothing to protect individual and corporate liberties from the relentless drive for fiscal military efficiency. There is no doubt that canals will be dug, roads laid, avenues and parks, theaters and pools created, cities illuminated, and we will shine and starve. The only robbers threatening the subject's property will be the tax collector and the French and German soldiers. Between equilibrium and instability, corpses and funeral pyres. By the time Haas submitted his memorandum, many felt the empire was nearing its end. However, when this came just 3 months later, it was no Götterdämmerung, with a redemptive leap into the funeral pyre involving a final battle to forge a bright new future. Instead, the empire fractured incrementally under relentless French battering. Contemporaries were fully aware that internal weaknesses hastened this process, if not directly causing it. In the subsequent search for explanations for Central Europe's subjugation to French imperialism, it was easy to blame the empire that had disappeared, rather than the princes who survived as rulers of larger, fully sovereign states, and who, as Haas predicted, were free to silence their critics. The overwhelming conclusion after 1806 has been that the empire had been dead already since at least 1648, if not 1250, and now stood like a corpse, ready to crumble at a touch. This interpretation usually contrasts a supposedly moribund imperial structure with the alleged dynamism of the larger German territories, notably Austria and Prussia. The recent, more positive reappraisal of the empire has the advantage of reflecting the lack of any sense of impending crisis prior to 1790, but has pushed revisionism too far in the opposite direction. Both approaches still view the empire in dualist terms, underestimating how far social and political structures were entwined. Although substantially altered, much of the empire's pre-modern social structures outlived it for several decades at least. This historical debate exists precisely because the situation remained open in the late 18th century, Many problems were surfacing, but they were not immediately life-threatening. Some institutions were no longer compatible with circumstances or were too inflexible, while others gained new momentum as they tackled immediate problems. This section explains why it proved so hard for those with a vested interest in the empire to envisage any other political structure for Central Europe.